Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2018, and you're listening to episode 94 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, an organization dedicated to equipping others to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. In the 2018 Volume 41, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Jay has written a book review on the book by Chris Capozzi called Choosing Down Syndrome, Ethics and New Prenatal Testing. His review is called Assessing a Pro-Choice Argument Against Aborting Children with Down Syndrome. Jay, it's good to have you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, this seems a little bit confusing to me because normally people who have a pro-life position are arguing for why all people matter, including people with disabilities. And with prenatal testing, a lot of times people are given the option to terminate a pregnancy when some abnormalities are found, like Down syndrome. But here is a guy, Chris Capozzi, and what I know about him is that he is a parent of a child with Down syndrome, and he's also pro-choice. So considering it's an argument against abortion, why isn't this, strictly speaking, a pro-life book? Why would he be pro-choice, yet, you know, value somebody, I guess, because he's a parent with Down syndrome?
You see this, it's a deeply personal book for him. That's one of the things that you get when you read it. Chris does not believe, Capozzi does not believe that the preborn human being is the kind of being that can be wronged. And so he argues this in public and in writing and all of his writings in bioethics. But his motivation for writing this book isn't a condemnation of abortion, not really even in the case of a prenatal diagnosis with Down syndrome or any other disability. He doesn't condemn abortion. He doesn't come down to the side that it's strictly speaking wrong. What he does is he approaches it as an encouragement for women and families to use this power of choice that he repeatedly recognizes and affirms throughout the book to choose to allow their children with Down syndrome to be born and then choose to parent them. So his argument isn't that aborting preborn children with Down syndrome is wrong. In the most simple terms, he's arguing that choosing to parent children with Down syndrome is good for the parents. It's good for the people living with Down syndrome. It's good for their families. It's just overall a benefit and a good to society. So he straddles that line. He refuses to condemn abortion. He even refuses to condemn it ultimately throughout the book on this particular case, but he wants to make an argument that is an encouragement to all people that what they know about Down syndrome is probably wrong. They've probably been misled about what it's like to live with it, what it does to families, that it's an overall good, and that they should choose to make this choice that they're allowed to make because it will be a benefit to them and ultimately a benefit to us all.
So specifically, why did, you know, the advancement of prenatal testing, specifically these new, you know, non-invasive prenatal tests, inspire him, and you mentioned that he is pro-choice, to write this, you know, full-length treatment in a book about the ethics of aborting preborn children with Down syndrome? You know, it's interesting, you know, my kids are older. I have one in college and one in high school now, but even back when I was pregnant, that's just such a big issue. I mean, they really press in the prenatal testing. And if you even refuse it when you're pregnant, they give you all this litany of reasons why you should have these prenatal testings. So, you know, why are these tests inspiring him to write this book?
Because prior to these new non-invasive forms of prenatal testing, the most common forms of prenatal testing were amniocentesis, where you penetrate the abdomen with a needle and you take amniotic fluid from the sac through the abdomen, or like chorionic villus sampling, which you would take a sample of the placenta either through the cervix or then again penetrating through the abdomen. Both of those carried with them a small risk of miscarriage. And because of that, there was a group of women not a monolithic or universally agreeing on all terms group of women, but a large group of women that would refuse to get these tests for fear of that. Now, part of that group of people that refused were people that were pro-life or just would never get an abortion. So if they were asked to do these tests to determine if there were any disabilities to look out for, what they would say was, look, I'm never going to abort this child no matter what. So there's no reason for me to risk this pregnancy, even with a small risk, and risk the life of my child when I have no intention of ever aborting a child, no matter what you tell me about them. But as he points out, there's a group of women that don't have that commitment to not abort their children, but did have a fear of causing harm to their unborn child. And that they combined that with a lack of certainty that the results were going to give them information that they needed, because those results from amniocentesis or from chorionic villus sampling, both of those were less reliable than what we're getting now. Now what you have with these non-invasive prenatal testing are simple maternal blood tests that represent no risk to the pregnancy that give you a much higher level of certainty about any diagnosis that they give you. So we've advanced to that position. And so what Chris Capozzi sees as a problem now at this point is that group of women who weren't in principle against aborting their children but had reasons to avoid that kind of information will now seek that out because it's easier for them to get and the information itself is more reliable. You've taken away the risk and you've given them a greater degree of certainty. And as he knows, with the percentages, it's in the United States, he says somewhere between about like 60 to 85% of prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome end in abortion. And Great Britain, it's over 90%. In some countries, you're looking at like the Netherlands or Iceland, you're looking at somewhere close to 100%. So if more women are finding out that they have children with Down syndrome with a greater degree of certainty and they have no in principle objection to abortion, then this, what the result of this non-invasive prenatal testing is going to be is a larger number of children with Down syndrome being aborted before they have the chance, the selective abortion of children with Down syndrome before they're allowed to be born. And so he feels that this drives him to want to make an argument then for why that would be a mistake. He's not against information and neither am I. I think we both agree as I read his book, I agree with him that information is not the enemy. There are some people that don't like prenatal testing because they think information causes bad behavior. He doesn't fall down on that side. He says more information is great, but we have to be careful about what information we give in addition to that. If they're going to find out that their child has Down syndrome, then we have to be very careful to make sure that they understand that has not had the negative connotations they may have been led to believe that it has.
So why does he in particular limit his criticism to decisions that are impacted by prenatal testing and not other forms of genetic tests like, you know, genetic screening done in like the, for example, the in vitro fertilization process?
Yeah, I think here we see the first great divergence where we started this out by saying this is not a pro-life book. This is not a pro-life guy. And though I can be sympathetic, I think my friend Scott Klusendorf years ago gave me a term that he had learned. We're co-belligerent on this. Both Chris Capozzi and I would object to the idea of aborting children with Down syndrome. But here you see the first split between us because he sees a differentiation between a pregnancy that has been developing that is interrupted by a diagnosis of Down syndrome and a pregnancy that is never allowed to begin through implantation. So he what he sees as wrong, or one of the things as he starts to parse out his theory of wrongness, is this idea that you wanted to be pregnant, you wanted to have a child, you developed happy with this pregnancy, you are moving along, making plans, looking forward, and then suddenly it's interrupted with this diagnosis at a later point. And what you say is, it's not that I don't want to be a parent. It's that I don't want to parent this child. And that's where he breaks it down and says, okay, we have a problem. And this is where I see I don't understand fully how he differentiates between making that decision in the middle of pregnancy, which he sees as a clear indication of bias against a child with Down syndrome, or making it prior to implantation, where he says, well, discarding the embryo is nothing. Not allowing the pregnancy really is just nothing. It's no big deal. You know, destroying an embryo because it has Down syndrome, you didn't allow the pregnancy to begin. So he doesn't, obviously, this goes back to the idea that unlike me as a pro-life person who argues from the position that all human life ought to be treated with dignity and respect, even nascent human life at the very beginning, from the moment we have a human being in front of us, we need to restrict our behavior to it in certain important ways. And at that particular stage, we just don't destroy human life or use it as an instrumental means to our ends. Where he says, well, at that stage of development, in this particular circumstances, throwing up an embryo is not really throwing away anything at all. And so since you didn't allow a pregnancy to start, it's no big deal. In the other case, when we're talking about that, what you're talking about is a pregnancy that developed, there was a love, a bond growing, an idea about being a parent to that child, and then you abandoned all of that because you found out the child would have Down syndrome. And he sees those as two distinctly different things.
As we mentioned, Kaposi is the parent of a child with Down syndrome. So how does he see our current cultural attitudes about living with a disability, like someone with Down syndrome, impact decisions that, you know, to allow children with Down syndrome to be born? I mean, I think it's really interesting because on the one hand, he's saying we don't know, we're not understanding that much about people with Down syndrome now that he's discovering because he is the parent of someone who has one. But at the same time, you know, the impact of the shock of something. I mean, if you're pregnant and you're told, you know, your child has Down syndrome, we can confirm that, you know, how do you make that jump to, okay, I think I can live with this as opposed to the child is already born and, you know, now I have to deal with it so that you wouldn't get, like you said, in some of those other countries, it's like 100% abortion of children with Down syndrome.
First of all, there's a class, he starts out by saying, I want to reject, there's a class of arguments we can discuss later that are called expressivist objections, or they're an idea of that you're, by aborting a child with Down syndrome, you're doing a different kind of harm. What he wants to do is begin to find fault with our concepts of well-being and flourishing. And what he's saying is that we have mistaken the idea of not well-being like me or flourishing like me with not well-being at all or flourishing at all. And so he wants to provide evidence, both empirical through study and also autobiographical, where people share anecdotal information about raising a child with Down syndrome or having a sibling with Down syndrome or being involved in the life of the child or being a person with Down syndrome, that they thrive, that they have fulfilling lives on their own terms, and that too many people are understanding their lives through the lens of what he would consider to be privation. And here he briefly takes shots at sort of like Aristotle or Thomistic ideas about the nature of human beings, because he said this concept of privation, and what he would mean is that there are goods to which we are ordered. There's an idea of what we ought to be. And when we don't have those things, we see that the privation, the absence of a full capacity to realize your rational capacities would be seen as a privation. And he says, by seeing that as a privation, understanding it through the lens of privation, then what we're doing is we're saying that they cannot be what we want them to be. They can't flourish in the way they were meant to flourish. And he says, no, there's evidence. You have to change your mind. What you have to see is that they do thrive. They do flourish. They just don't thrive and flourish in the way that you might have wanted them to, or the way that you might have understood thriving and flourishing, but it is genuinely there.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Jay Watts. Jay has written a book review about the book Choosing Down Syndrome, Ethics and New Prenatal Testing Technologies by Chris Kaposi, and it is published in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal. And his review is called Assessing a Pro-Choice Argument Against Aborting Children with Down Syndrome. So to read his book review, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe online, please visit our website, equip.org. We were talking about his view of human flourishing and maybe our expectations of what that is with regards to someone with Down syndrome. So what's the difference between the expressivist objection to aborting preborn with disabilities that you mentioned and his arguments in favor of choosing to parent a child with Down syndrome?
Expressivist objections, and this would not be just particular to Down syndrome, this would cover all disabilities, they would see a causal link between aborting children either with Down syndrome or other disabilities that feeds a societal view of that disability. And so what they would say is choosing to abort at that point, choosing to selectively terminate for the reason of disability feeds a view that that disability is something that people ought not to live with or that it is not a life worth living. And as a result, more people value the disabled less, which leads to greater bias, which leads to greater abuse, or greater dismissal, in which this ultimately will lead to more abortion. So in that particular case, for the expressivist objections, what they would say is you can't do this because by the very act of doing it, you feed a view that will cause more harm. And among those harms will be more abortions. Capozzi rejects that as a form of argument. I mean, he does caution against it. He says, in the sense that he said, anything that feeds a bias based on false understandings should be gotten rid of. But he rejects that idea of a causal link that we need to argue from. His arguments focus on goods produced through choosing to parent a child with Down syndrome, including the high number of people with Down syndrome reporting satisfaction with their lives. He talks about the love and pride of their parents and their siblings, the manner in which they help those close to them reprioritize in the best sense of that word. The expressive form of arguments point to harms to the disabled in our society, while Capozzi focuses on goods born out of a proper understanding of what is gained through the lives of the people with Down syndrome.
So how does Chris Capozzi defend his arguments from, I guess he mentions in the book, the charge that, you know, he is citing these very overly optimistic memoirs about people who are, you know, parents of Down syndrome children. And how does he know that they're not anecdotal accounts that are corrupted by adaptive preference, for example?
And adaptive preference, for your listeners, is the idea that you have somebody who lives under objectively terrible situations or even just objective privation. They're lacking something. And yet these people report being happy and content with their lives. They're happy with the circumstances they're in, not just overcoming it, but what they're talking about is the idea that they see this as adaptive preference, that they have adapted themselves to believe that this is somehow good for them, the way that they're living their life. And oddly enough, the people who are charging with this point out Tiny Tim from A Christmas Carol as their paradigm of this. I personally find that bizarre, since I don't think they fully grasp what Tiny Tim is supposed to represent in that story.
That is odd.
Yeah, it is a strange person if they did that, because Tiny Tim is not supposed to be adaptive preference. He is supposed to be the symbol of hope in the midst of suffering, and somebody who sees a true Christian relationship for that story. But what he says, composing in response to this, points out a couple of different things. He says one of them is that they missed the idea that these grieving parents didn't trick themselves into believing that they were happy with the situation beyond any objective need or ability to be happy. What they did was they reprioritized their life. They did grieve the loss of this ideal child, but then they woke up one day and realized that they wanted to parent the child they actually had. And they wanted to be the best parents they possibly could. And beyond Down syndrome, if you talk to any parent of a medically fragile child, we have a type 1 diabetic daughter, my 14-year-old daughter, diagnosed at 8. I think my wife would tell you that there are deep challenges that have gone on with having a daughter, because I'm on the road. I don't have to do as much as my wife. But at the same time, there have been aspects of this that have drawn them closer in a relationship than they would have ever had she not had this medical condition of diabetes. And so what he says is they're missing the fact that people are reprioritizing, that they're finding through some symbol, what he would call some approaching of virtue ethics, this consideration of what is the ideal parent? What is a virtuous parent? And how do they respond to this kind of scenario? And that they're doing very well. They didn't make the best of a bad situation. They made themselves a better person in a situation they didn't expect. And he says their dismissal of it, their blankest dismissal of it, they're presupposing that the types of limitations that are introduced through Down syndrome are so insurmountable that all of these people reporting happiness and contentment and love and pride and thriving and fulfillment, they must be deluded. And at the end of the day, he says that's just so presumptuous of them to make that you can't do that. You can't just dismiss all of these reports because you see this is so insurmountable to flourishing that you believe anybody who says I'm happy, I love, I have pride, it's good for us. It's been a positive, a blessing to us, or they just must be adaptive preference. They must be saying something they don't really genuinely feel because they had to make the best of this. He said it's not making the best of a bad situation. It genuinely is making people better people.
If Capozzi thinks that the pre-born human is the type of being that can't be wronged, then what's wrong in his argument in killing a pre-born human that's diagnosed with Down syndrome?
His wrongness is interesting. His wrongness, he says, is because if you do this, if you selectively abort a child with Down syndrome, you are acting in ignorance of reality. That would be one of the things that he says. So you're not acting in accordance with real information. You're acting out of fear, bias, prejudice that is rooted in ignorance. He says you fail to attain that idea of virtuous parenting that I mentioned earlier, that what you're doing is you are not loving the child that you have, but you are loving an ideal child that doesn't exist, and that you can't guard yourself against the bad things going to happen anyway. But he said, the problem with this is that your bias, your ignorance, that you're reducing the whole of another human being to a particular aspect of that person, that they are not only Down syndrome. That's not the whole of what they are. But if you see them as such, if you reduce them to that, you don't just do them wrong. You do and contribute to a wrong to society. So he rejects the idea that the unborn themselves can be wronged. But what he sees is these additional wrongs. I would like to add, I don't disagree with him about those wrongs. I would not say, but simply because I'm pro-life and I see additional evil, and quite frankly, I would say greater evil in the intentional and unjust destruction of an innocent human life because they fail to meet some standard that we want. That would be where I would begin with the additional and the highest level of wrong that's being done here is the wrong to that child for attacking them and killing them before they're born. But I also agree with him that there's all these additional evils. And I think I love the work of Christopher Kaiser that he has done through the years of talking about this particular element. He said, look, when another person offers a rationalization or justification for or against hurting another human being that doesn't fully encapsulate what it means to be a pro-lifer, it doesn't mean that I have to reject the wrongness that they see. I can embrace those wrongnesses, that wrongness theory as well. What I say is those are additional wrongs to a greater wrong. And so I'm actually in support of all of those. I think this book is at his best when he is making this case. I think he misses the ability to make that last leap and to say it's wrong because they're human beings. For us as Christians, they're image bearers of God, and you simply shouldn't treat them that way. But I do see and agree that the idea of what he's saying, all of those things would be wrongs. I just think they're not strong enough. And he admits that, by the way, they're not strong enough to ultimately get an ought out of. He says, I can't tell you that you ought not to get an abortion. What I can tell you is that I can highly encourage you to not do so because it would be good for you. But at the end of the day, he can't condemn anyone. He says that. I can't condemn anyone for the choices that they make. I can't say that it's wrong. What I can say is that letting them live would be a good thing to do. And I think that that ultimately is where you see the weakness of it. And I think he senses that as well by the way he writes. He says some people will see this as just insufficient.
How does he envision more societal awareness about people with Down syndrome, that they have a different kind of human flourishing than we do? Because, you know, when the woman, you know, has the results of her test and is told this, I mean, if she's not familiar with those arguments, how would she even know that, hey, later on, if you knew all the surveys, you'd be super happy and this person would be super happy, even though they have Down syndrome? I mean, how does he expect that, you know, this view could be embraced more widely as a society?
Well, here's where he says the burden on us is if we have, which we have, having developed this non-invasive prenatal testing method that he says evidence suggests will undoubtedly mean the deaths of more children with Down syndrome before they're born, then we also have to take on the responsibility of immediately giving the information that we give in relation to any disabilities that are identified through non-invasive prenatal pregnancy testing with information about the disabilities themselves. So he says that's where we have to step up our game. I mentioned earlier, he's not about restricting access to information. And I don't think anybody who values truth and information ought to be. What he says, though, is that with certain information, we have to recognize that people make certain steps that we can foresee. And so we have to take responsibility to also give additional information. We need to have a more open exchange about what it means to live with disability. And in this particular case, he says, I can argue from experience and I can argue from research and data and empirical evidence that in this particular disability, that the wrongs that you perceive or the challenges you perceive will ultimately be less than the benefits that you will gain through choosing to parent a child with Down syndrome. So he says the access to new information puts a burden on us to get out additional information to that. If we're going to tell them earlier that they have a child with Down syndrome. We also need to be better at telling them immediately, but this is what that means. So please consider this. Now, unfortunately, in the greater scheme of things with his argument of the pro-choice position, he does end up with a weak argument, because what he's wanting to do is immediately encourage them to do something. He tries to undermine that a little bit, or to undergird his by saying, we also have to tell them additional things, like not just that choosing Down syndrome will be good for you, but he says, there's no way you're going to have, you can't guarantee your next child won't have Down syndrome or have the same disabilities. You can't guarantee your child will be healthy during the course of your life. And so I think there, his lack of ability just to say it's wrong to kill other human beings for any reason in this particular category because they're human, it starts to show he needs you to give a ton of information at that output. And it goes beyond the empirical data. It starts to go into these warnings about what could happen to future children. And so really, there, don't you see him starting to lose some of that positivity that he was arguing with earlier? And it sort of squeaks through here and there. There is a negative aspect to him. I think he's always at his best when he's positive. And these negative things, I'm not even sure if he always sees them or senses them as he's starting to write them.
You mentioned in the review that Capozzi, this is not to be a political type of thing, but he does talk about economics, and you write that he has a very low view of capitalism, and he has the last chapter in his book as a criticism of that economic system as it relates to people with Down syndrome. So how does he see capitalism in particular hurting people with Down syndrome and having that economic system contribute to overwhelmingly to people choosing to abort children with Down syndrome?
Yeah, this chapter very much felt like somebody grinding a political axe. It really felt like somebody who had done what I felt like was fairly good yeoman work in a lot of areas, even coming out of the gates with some weaknesses that I perceive. And then all of a sudden it was time to grind his own political axe. And why I say that is because he is mostly a gracious guy through the book. And in this particular area, he becomes wholly ungracious. His attack on capitalism is fueled by this idea that capitalism is the worship of market success. And it contributes to what he would consider to be this middle class syndrome. And he sees that as part of, he mentions that several times in the book. The idea that you can't be a white collar middle class person somehow makes you lower or lesser, because capitalism is all about success. It's about judging everybody what they can accomplish through this sort of fierce individual efforts. Those who can't attain, those who fall behind in the system, are somehow lesser. And so when you find out your child has Down syndrome, you suddenly look at them and how they are going to survive in a market system, and they lack the ability to compete at that level. And so he sees this overall capitalist mindset as contributing to immediately seeing them as lesser. And then also because he equates capitalism with a lack of financial institution or resource support for things like Down syndrome. He sees it as diverting things towards frivolous needs and not towards those needy people who in categories of those people in Down syndrome are not getting the resources that they need or could fail to get those resources, which is strange because he does start the book out with acknowledging that in the last 20 years, we have seen remarkable change in how we, or 40 years, we've seen a remarkable change in the way that we treat people with Down syndrome. In the 20th century, they were largely institutionalized. They didn't get the resources they need to have things like a heart surgery to deal with the heart problems or to deal with other problems that were prevalent. In the early 80s, their life expectancy was somewhere about 25 years old, now it's 60. So there has been a remarkable change. And he fails to meet that optimism. He comes in condemning all of it. He doesn't see the resources that could be presented to give more. What he sees is only the negative, only that it fuels a sense that they're lesser because they can't succeed.
Well, this has been a very interesting discussion. Finally, I want to end with some rapid fire questions, some fun ones for Jay. So it's October, Jay. Pumpkin spice latte or pumpkin pie?
Pumpkin pie. I am not a latte or coffee drinker at all. So.
Mm. So what's one of your favorite hobbies?
Lacrosse. I could say the other stuff, reading, which I do, but almost everybody that does this sort of thing reads a ton. I love lacrosse. My kids started playing it when they were younger, and now after several years, my favorite part of the day when I come home from the road is when I get up with my kids early in the morning, and because they're homeschooled, we have flexibility in our schedule. We go to a public park and we just play lacrosse together. We set up goals, we run drills. I coach lacrosse. I do all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, I just love the sport and I love playing it. And I love playing it with my family. And it's something that's brought a tremendous joy to my life.
Wow, that's great. That's one of those not as widely played sports as probably should be. Well, are you an introvert or extrovert?
Deeply introverted.
And how old were you when you became a Christian?
22 years old. I grew up non-Christian and an unchristian. I'm in a household in the South. You know, I love Ben Witherington's term. It's a Jesus haunted culture. I mean, that's there. I mean, Jesus is sort of a specter over everything when you grow up in the South, but I never had any interest in it. And I was an atheist all through middle school, high school, college. I used to argue and fight with people about it. And when I was 22 years old, is when I became a Christian. And it was a radical change for me because I just didn't know. I didn't know anything about I didn't grow up with a knowledge of it. And so I had no church experience, hated Christians. They hated me. And so there was a radical change that had to accompany me. And I would say that it contributed to my, I am a totally different person. Anybody who knew me then in high school would be shocked or are quite frankly shocked when they find out what I do now, because my kids are shocked when they hear about what I was like when I was younger and how crazy I was and wild I was and all the trouble that I got into and how disrespectful and awful I was. I was a genuinely bad human being. Not all atheists are, but I would say that I was. And at the age of 22, I woke up one morning and saw the evidence for God as something that I felt was overwhelming. And I started praying. And then all of a sudden I had to say, hey, look, I think I'm a Christian. Now I got to figure out what that means. And it was a different life. It was a radical life change. And obviously I'm grateful for it now. It's a much better life that I lead.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast and for sharing your testimony too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Today's guest is Jay Watts. Jay has written a book review in the 41 number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal of the book Choosing Down Syndrome, Ethics, and New Prenatal Testing Technologies by Chris Capozzi. And if you would like to read his book review, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe online, go to our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes. And when you rate and review our podcast, it helps others to find our content. So please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged. It's Hank's new audio podcast. You'll follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.